Well, hey, how are you guys today? All right. Yeah, I'm looking forward to some frozen lemonade, no doubt. I'm into that, totally into that kind of thing. Well, welcome, whether you're joining us here in person or whether you're joining us online. Thanks for being with us. My name's Carter. I'm one of the pastors here at Redemption Church. And if you're new, I want to say a special welcome to you. This is a great day for you to visit because we are starting a new series in Ruth. So you can go ahead and turn there to Ruth chapter 1 today if you want to follow along in your Bible or on your device. We'll have it up on the screens for you as well if you need it. But I want to start by asking you a very simple question with some profound impact for your life. It's a little heavy, but just go with me on this and just think about it for just a second. I want you to evaluate your relationship with God. Yeah, so just a small thing, right? Just a very small thing, okay? Just think about that for a second. Where are you with God in your life? What's your relationship look like? If you have one, maybe you're here and you don't have a relationship at all. You wouldn't say that you know God or that you believe in God. Man, I'm glad you're here figuring things out, exploring things with us. Thanks for being here. If that's you and that's your situation, your relationship with God is no relationship. Or maybe for you, you grew up in church or something like that, but you've kind of moved away from the faith and you thought you'd give it one more shot by coming this morning or listening to this online. I'm so thankful that you're joining us. If that's you, I'm glad you're here as well. So maybe your relationship is tenuous at best, you would say, with God. I don't know. But maybe for others of you, you're here and you would say you follow God and you know who Jesus is. And maybe you're a fairly serious Christian, but you know it's easy for you to get distracted. You know, maybe you're not really following him like you want to today. Or maybe things in your life, if this is your story, have gone bad, as we've been singing about. And, you know, you think about the wrong things that have happened or the bad things that have either happened because of you or that have happened to you, not of any fault of your own. And maybe you're frustrated. Maybe you're hearing you even say you're a little bitter toward God, at the very least indifferent, you know. Maybe that's your story. I don't know where you're at. You have to evaluate your relationship with God on your own. But wherever you are on that spectrum in your relationship with him, the book of Ruth is going to have something for you, especially today, but I think for the next 4 weeks as we get into this book together, because it's a book that illustrates God's presence and involvement in our lives, even when we don't see it, even when we can't feel it. It's kind of like the iceberg concept, you know, where there's only a little bit at the top that you can see, and there's this massive thing under the waters that you can't see that's there and present. That's kind of how it is with God and him working in our lives. Maybe we can see just a little bit of what he's doing, but he's under the surface doing so much more than we could ever imagine. And I think that we're going to see that through Ruth. And in the Bible, the thing that drives him to do that and to work under the surface on our behalf, for us and through us, is his love. It's this thing called Chesed, you know, so if you're super Jewish, you got to say it with a ch sound. It's the Chesed. It's his love. And the easiest way to give a definition for that that I can is that Chesed is loyal love that lasts. That's what we see throughout the Bible. It's this loyal love that lasts. It's love that endures. There's really no English equivalent for the word. So we have to kind of phrase together some things. But in the Bible, we see it translated as like faithful love, or unfailing love, or loyal loving kindness, or steadfast love. So every time you see those words in the Bible, you might be able to say that's probably chesed underneath of that. And it's this love that leads to promises kept and compassion demonstrated. It's love that works itself out over time for long periods of time. And it's used about 250 times in the Old Testament. So it's a love that is mentioned a lot in the Bible. A few examples include when God shows up at Mount Sinai, for example, when all the people come out of Egypt and they're in the wilderness. Exodus 34, he says that he's abounding in chesed, or his steadfast love for his people. Or in Numbers 14, when Moses intercedes on behalf of the people as they're in the wilderness, and he asks God to show chesed to them, his unfailing love, by pardoning all of their sins that they've committed when they, you know, do the idolatrous thing in the wilderness. Or Daniel 9, Daniel even says this, that God keeps his chesed, his steadfast love, for those who love him and keep his commandments. So it's this loyal love that lasts on for time. And we need to see that other people in the Bible also exhibit this. So it's not just God exhibiting this, but it's people that exhibit this in the Old Testament. So here in our story that we're going to read in Ruth, Naomi demonstrates chesed toward Ruth. And then later on, Ruth is going to demonstrate chesed toward Naomi. And then we'll see even later that Boaz demonstrates chesed toward both Ruth and Naomi. But under all of that, throughout the entire story, God is showing his chesed, his lasting loyal love. He's showing that to his people, including Ruth and Naomi. God's working underneath the whole thing, under the surface. So as we get into chapter 1 today, we're going to see that loyal love that lasts is a major theme for us throughout the rest of the entire book for the next 4 weeks that we're in this. So as we get into it, we'll see how that plays out more and more. But today, what we're going to do is be pushed to lean into that chesed, to see the love that God has for us and to lean into it. So here's our main point if you're taking notes and you want to write this down. Lean in to God's love today. Lean into that love. See the love and how it's being demonstrated toward you, even if it's under the surface, even if you don't feel like it, and you don't feel that love necessarily. Try to recognize it in your life and lean into that love that God has. You know, the idea of leaning in means that you don't run away, right? When you lean into something, you're getting closer to it. You're leaning in. You're allowing it to influence your life in some way. Caitlin, one of our leaders here, she told me this week a story how she listened to a comedian named Jaron Myers. I've never heard of this guy, but she said he's great. But one of the experiments that he did during his comedic times was that he thought it would be really interesting if people could watch him have a first date on stage, like a legitimate first date. And so what he does is he ends up inviting this girl on a date, and she thinks she's just going to a comedy show with him, and she is, but she doesn't know what it's going to be like. And so when she gets there, he has this whole elaborate thing where he like has people out in the lobby. So he tells the people in the audience, hey, this is what today is going to look like, and I'm going to need some of you guys to go back out into the lobby and get tickets so that when my date gets here, she thinks that we're all just part of the show. And then she sets down, and he says, hey, my name's, you know, Jaron, and I'm going to be talking to you tonight, but I'm going to have a special guest here, my date, so whatever her name was. And he calls her up on stage, and she's just like, what is going on here, you know? If it would have been me, I would have run away, okay? I would have just turned and ran. This is really weird and creepy. I'm not doing this. But she actually leaned in to the awkward, and she got up on stage, and she allowed it to happen. And you think, man, this is going to be really weird. Maybe she just drops him after that. Well, she ended up dating him for a couple of years, and now they're getting married. So something worked. I don't know what happened. She leaned into the awkward hard, okay? And if it had been me, the dad in me is like, turn and run from this dude. He's a wacko, right? But she leaned in, and now they're getting married. Very interesting but ridiculous situation. I think that's what we ought to do with God and his love, though. That's what the story is going to tell us, is to lean in. Lean in not just to the awkward, but even to the hard, even to the difficult. Because we're going to see Naomi go through very difficult circumstances. And instead of running from God further, she's going to turn and she's going to look at God and she's going to lean in, even in her bitterness, even in the hard times. She's going to lean into that. And so that's what we're going to see in the story today with Ruth and Naomi. She leans into God's love instead of leaving his love. So let's get into the story here. In case you don't know Ruth and you've never read it, it's a short little book that reads almost like a novella or a short story. It's very beautiful. The author is anonymous, so we don't know who wrote it, but it's a really impactful story, and it's a piece of Israel's history. It tells the lineage of David, King David, so it's a part of his mythos or, you know, his mythology as a king, but people take this as a historical narrative, and this is what happened and led up to his birth, and so it's a really interesting book for a lot of different reasons, but let's go ahead and jump in and read this together. We're going to read the whole first chapter as we go through. I'm going to read it and stop and talk and then read more and stop and talk. And so that's how it'll look for today. But let's go ahead and go to verse 1. It said, during the time of the judges, there was a famine in the land, and a man left Bethlehem in Judah with his wife and two sons to stay in the territory of Moab for a while. The man's name was Elimelech, and his wife's name was Naomi. And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. And they were Ephrathites from Bethlehem in Judah. And they entered the fields of Moab, and they settled there. All right, so this, let's get the setting for the story. It sets us all up here for what's going to happen next. And there's a lot of history. If you don't know Israel's history, let me catch you up just real quick on this. Judges is the book right before Ruth. And it was about 400-year period of time in Israel's history after they came out of the wilderness and they came into the promised land. And everyone did what was right in their own eyes, Judges 17 tells us. That's this time period. It's kind of a rebellion. God has delivered them from slavery in Egypt. They're in the promised land. They have to go in and conquer parts of it. And then they live in a way that's really selfish and self-centered, and they kind of forget about God during this time. So it's kind of a dark period in Israel's history. And in the beginning of Judges, though, it's really big stuff. Like they're coming in and they're conquering. The first tribe to go in and conquer part of the land is Judah. So it's really interesting that Elimelech is from the tribe of Judah. These are hyperlinks that should say, hey, I want you to know some stuff here. They go back to parts of the Bible that we should know already if we're reading this story as an Israelite. But it's ironic because Elimelech is not going into the land to conquer it. Now he's running away out of the land because of a famine. So there's this really interesting play on words and a juxtaposition here, an irony that we need to see, because that's not how it should go. God's people shouldn't be leaving the land that he gave them now. They should be thriving in the land, and instead there's this famine and they're not thriving, and so Elimelech, rather than try to trust God during this period of time, he doesn't trust God and he leaves, he runs. He runs away, takes his family, and he leaves God's people in God's presence, and he lives in rebellion away, and they go to Moab, which is an enemy nation, and they settle there in enemy territory. That's really interesting language as well. So Elimelech would rather give up the land that God gave to him and his ancestors rather than trust God during this hard time of famine, trust God to provide. He didn't do that, so he ran away. So you can write this down for us as a warning, I think. It's easy to leave God's love when we don't get what we want. Man, that's super easy, right? God's not doing what we think he ought to do, so we leave, we tuck tail, and we run. And of course, I see this happen to Christians all the time in the church today. Life's not going the way they want. They don't have what they want. They don't get what they want. So they'd rather seek something else other than God. They'd rather change their living situation rather than change their heart, right? So they don't want to lean in. They want to leave God and in search of satisfaction and sustenance somewhere else. And once they enter into that territory, what we would call enemy territory, where they've run from God, they settle there. And that's how they start living their lives. Sure, they may go to church. They may say they're believers. They may say they're Christians. But that's not how they live their life at all. They've settled somewhere else. And oftentimes, I think that most American Christians think we're in the promised land because we're in America, right? We're so blessed. We have so many possessions and so much wealth here that we just take it for granted that these are all blessings from God that he's provided for us. And instead, we grow concerned about our financial portfolio or our career moves or the school that we're going to go to or the sports that our kids should play, you know, if they're going to be successful in life and all these different things. And we forget about God's purpose and plan for our lives in favor of our own purpose and our own plan for our own lives. But man, if we're Christians, the purpose that God has for us is to be a blessing to the people around us. That's what Israel was supposed to be to Moab, the enemy of God. And the plan was for him to use them to share his love with other nations around. That's what he's supposed to do with us. Our purpose is to live for God, to be a blessing to those around us. And the plan is for him to use us to bring other people into the kingdom and other people into the family through the love that God has for us and that we should have for them. And the only way we're going to live that out is if we start trusting the circumstances that God puts us in, whether they're good or bad. Whether we have things that we want or we don't have things that we want, we have to decide to put our trust in God above all things. We should lean into his love in the circumstances that we face, not leave his love, depending on what circumstances they are, just because we don't like them. That's what we see going on here in this story. You know, it's the same for Elimelech. He actually left the promised land and settled in a place far from God. He didn't want anything to do with it. His circumstances weren't the way that he thought they should be, and so he left with his family and led his family there, and they settled there in this enemy territory. And this is what verse 3 says. Naomi's husband Elimelech died, and she was left with her two sons. And her sons took Moabite women as their wives. One was named Orpah, the second was named Ruth. And after they lived in Moab about 10 years, both Mahlon and Chilion also died. And the woman was left without her two children and without her husband. So it really, for Naomi, goes from bad to worse. They're already running from God as a family, and then she loses everything while she's there. The Israelites weren't supposed to intermarry with Moabites. I don't know if you realize this from the Levitical law. If you know your Levitical law, you know that these guys aren't doing what they're supposed to do, right? But hey, their dad had run away from God. He hadn't led them in the ways of God, so his sons didn't live in the ways of God. Parents, that's something for us to take note of, right? So they end up marrying these women that worship other gods. That's why they weren't supposed to intermarry, is because the Moabites didn't worship the one true God. They worshiped gods that they'd created for themselves. And you're not supposed to do that in Levitical law. And it doesn't say why, but the sons die also. So their father died, then they died, and now Naomi's devastated. She's left with nothing, basically. She has her two daughters-in-law, but they're left without protection and provision. And if you know anything about this time period, the family was everything in these days. Like, the husband provided protection and provision. The wife led the household and raised the children. And if you didn't have a family, you were really a nobody. You were not successful in life. You know how in our society, to be successful, you just really need a career, right? You need an education and you need a career. And then you're successful. You can be somebody. Well, in these days, to be somebody, you needed a family like this so that you could pass on the lineage and they could work the land with you. And you had more wealth. The more kids you had, the better off you were. That's why you see all these kings in the Old Testament who were super wealthy have all kinds of kids. It was a sign of wealth. You were successful if you had a family, and she'd lost it all. She was devastated. It was like she'd lost her job and her career and all this stuff. It was like she lost everything in her life. But then something changes in the story at this point as we get into the next verses here in chapter 6, because she's reminded of God's goodness. And then instead of doing what she's been doing, which is running away, she takes steps toward God. This is what it says in verse 6. She and her daughters-in-law set out to return from the territory of Moab because they'd heard in Moab, while they were there, that the Lord had paid attention to his people's need by providing them food. Very interesting setup here now, because this is what Israel is supposed to do for all the nations around to begin with. When God is good to Israel, everybody else sees it, and she hears about it while she's in Moab. So this is the purpose of God's people is playing out before our very eyes here, and she's seeing that. She's hearing of God's goodness. And so verse 7, she left the place where she'd been living, accompanied by her two daughters-in-law, and traveled along the road leading back to the land of Judah. I hope you're starting to see the insightfulness and the beauty of this story here, because it's this literary visualization of somebody actually coming back to the faith in God. That's what's really interesting about this. Naomi was essentially wandering in sin. You know, she was far from God, but she hears about his goodness again. She's reminded of what it's like to be in God's presence with God's people, and so she takes steps to go back. That's what's really interesting here. That's what's beautiful about this. She and her family had been running, but now she leans in. You can think of Israel as the place where God's presence was. At this time, you remember when they were in the wilderness coming out for 40 years, they had a tabernacle that they set up as a tent of meeting with God, and God's real presence dwelled with his people there. And so as they entered the land during the period of the judges, that tabernacle was set up in Shiloh and in Bethel, so it kind of moved around some, but the idea is that God's real presence was with his people in Israel, and that's how this looked to all the nations around. God's presence was there. So when you left the land, you were really leaving God's presence. And that's what they had been doing here. So the promised land was representative of his presence on earth. And as Elimelech and Naomi left, they were leaving a relationship with God and his people, but going back now. See, Naomi is making a commitment to start seeking after God once again. She's saying, I have done wrong. She's repenting, essentially. She's recognizing her wrongdoing, and she's turning to God. But it's really interesting because she's super complex here, right? This is not a just, hey, oh, you know, I heard of God's goodness, and now it's all good now, and I'm going to go back, and I, you know, joy and hallelujah, praises. No. That's not what happens, right? She's still bitter. So that's really interesting here, right? She's still bitter. She's bitter toward God for what's happened in her life, and yet she takes steps back toward his presence. Very intriguing here, what's going on in the story. She leans back in, so you can write it down like this for us as you apply this to your life. It's never too late to lean into God's love. It's never too late to do that. You can still do that today. Because in those moments where we've lost everything, or things aren't going our way, or we're wandering and we're lost, we have no idea what our future holds, or we're living in selfishness and sinfulness, and we're running from God, God's love is still there waiting for us to return to him over and over and over again. We can always lean in again. That's what he wants for us. He commands us to lean back in. It's never too late to do that. And you might be like, yeah, but you don't know what I've done. You don't know how I've been living my life. I've done too many things. I've done X, Y, or Z. But listen, she was running away from God for more than 10 years. She was living in enemy land, allowed her children to marry people who did not worship her God. She basically had just left the faith. And yet,
And yet God welcomes her back with open arms here. So it's really interesting stuff that's going on in this story. And she's still bitter. Remember, she's still got a problem, but she takes steps to go back. Thank God he's patient with us, you know. She leaned into his love even when she wasn't feeling his love. She was feeling bitterness, but she leaned in anyway when she heard and was reminded of his goodness. And so rather than letting her bitterness consume her completely, she starts the journey back toward God. And it's a hard journey. She goes. This is what it says in verse 8. Naomi said to them, talking to her daughters-in-law, "Each of you go back to your mother's home. May the Lord show his kindness to you as you've shown to the dead and to me. May the Lord grant each of you rest in the house of a new husband." And she kissed them, and they wept loudly. And they said to her, "We insist on returning with you to your people." But Naomi replied, "Return home, my daughters. Why do you want to go with me? Am I able to have any more sons who could become your husbands? Return home, my daughters. Go on, for I'm too old to have another husband. Even if I thought there was still hope for me to have a husband tonight and to bear sons, would you be willing to wait for them to grow up? Would you restrain yourselves from remarrying? No, my daughters. My life is much too bitter for you to share, because the Lord's hand has turned against me." Again, they wept loudly, and Orpah kissed her mother-in-law. But Ruth clung to her. And Naomi said, "Look, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Follow your sister-in-law." But Ruth replied, "Don't plead with me to abandon you, to return and not to follow. For wherever you go, I will go. And wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people, and your God will be my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord punish me, and do so severely, if anything but death separates you and me." So this is really where our main characters of the story start to be parsed out, and we see that it's Ruth and Naomi against the world here, right? They're after it together, Thelma and Louise style, and they form, well, maybe not quite that style, right? Okay. And they form this very non-traditional family unit, mother-in-law, daughter-in-law, and they're together, and they're moving back toward Israel, toward God's presence and God's people. And this is where Ruth begins to show her chesed for Naomi, right? Because she's saying, no, I'm not going to leave you. I'm going to stay with you. And she essentially becomes an Israelite. She's committing to become one of God's people. And in this famous line that we always hear from Ruth, "Wherever you go, I will go. Wherever you live, I will live. Your people will be my people and your God will be my God." This is what we hear from Ruth all the time. It's really interesting. We usually hear it in a wedding, right? But this is not between a husband and a wife at all. It's between a mother-in-law and a daughter-in-law. I'm not sure why it's in weddings, but that's maybe somebody not knowing their Bible. Anyway, but as Ruth comes to the place of commitment here, it's really interesting because it's really a conversion. It's not just a commitment to Naomi. It's a conversion to God. Right? Because the story is begging us to ask a question here when we get to this. Why? Why in the world would Ruth want to follow Naomi back to her people and back to God's presence? Why in the world would she follow her even to the point of believing in her God? And it's clear that at least in the context of this story, it's because Naomi's chesed has made such an impact on her, right? I mean, here's what you can write down and then I'll explain it. Ruth was led by God to God by Naomi's love for her. See, Ruth was led to God by Naomi's love. And it seems really unlikely if you think about it, because why would Ruth be attracted to Naomi's God after seeing all of this unfold for so many years? She could have just as easily scoffed at God and said, "You know what? God's the one that killed my husband. He's the one that killed my father-in-law and took all of our protection and our provision away from us." She could look in and scoff and say, "Why in the world would God allow a famine if he really exists? You know, he didn't take care. He wasn't powerful enough to provide for his people even." But she doesn't do any of that, does she? That's what's really interesting. She even sees Naomi's bitterness, and she chooses to follow God. What is it that has done that? Well, it's got to be Naomi's relationship with her. Because think about Naomi here and what's happened. She felt bitter toward God, and yet she took steps toward him anyway. And that's probably really intriguing to Ruth, just on the surface of it. Why would Naomi go back to God, even if she's bitter? There's something really intriguing about a God that people can just go back to, that's willing to welcome them with open arms, even when that person is angry at that God that they believe in. That's intriguing on the surface of it, number one. But then Naomi shows such unfailing love toward Ruth and Orpah by telling them to return to their people so that they can have a family, so they can be successful, right? You know, we might look at that and say, well, she didn't want them with her. You know, it was maybe a slap in the face or what, but that's not it. She obviously had become like a mother to them. I mean, there's weeping, there was kissing. They didn't want to leave. They loved one another. So she intimately knew and loved them, and that impacted Ruth in this way, to the point where Ruth clung to her. You know, Orpah ended up going back. We don't know why. No fault to Orpah. I mean, Naomi told her to go. But Ruth wanted to stay because of this relationship that she had with Naomi, despite the fact that she would probably never marry again. Despite the fact that when she went to Israel, they knew they'd probably face hardship because they would be destitute. They wouldn't have anybody to provide for them. So her telling them to leave was actually chesed toward them because she was trying to do what was best for their future. No doubt Ruth felt that deeply, and that impacted her, and she didn't want to lose that relationship, and something happened in the middle of that. She decided to follow Naomi's God. Very interesting here. Her love for Ruth led Ruth to a love for God. And so as we apply this to ourselves today, you can write this down also. Our love for our neighbors can lead them to love for God. Okay? Our love can do that with people. Now, I don't want to make too much of a blanket statement, right? Because that's not always the case. You can love somebody until the day they die or until the day you die first, whichever comes first, and they may never follow God. That may not be how God works it out for them. It could just be the way it is. But it certainly can't hurt, right? It certainly doesn't hurt. It's actually the first step for people who are coming to God is to learn to love and trust somebody who's a Christian. I actually read a book, and I'm reading a book right now. I'm listening to a book, so I like to listen. So I'm not really reading it, but I'm listening. It's called I Once Was Lost, What Postmodern Skeptics Taught Us About Their Path to Jesus. Very interesting book because it was written by some guys who worked in the college ministry, InterVarsity, if you've ever heard that. And they worked in InterVarsity for over 20 years. And so they have story after story of all these conversions that they'd seen, and they wanted to try to figure out what it was that led people to become Christians. How did these people in this collegiate setting end up going from lost to saved? What did this look like for people? And so they compiled all these stories, and they came up with five thresholds, is what they call them, of steps that people must take in order to follow Jesus. Now, they're like, listen, we could be wrong, but over 20 years, we started this 10 years ago, and then 10 years went by, and we came back together, and we were thinking, surely these thresholds won't hold up in our context. And they said every story that they talked about, they saw these thresholds play out in one way or another. We actually see it with Ruth, and I won't go through all of them. Well, I'll give you all five of them, and then I'll go through the first one as to how it applies to us today. But it's trust a Christian. That's the first threshold that people have to cross. And then they have to become curious about what that Christian believes. And then they have to be willing to change after they are starting to be confronted with things that are wrong in their life. And then they have to actually start to actively seek God on their own and want to believe this truth that these Christians believe. And then they finally have to go from death to life where they take that commitment and they actually say, I'm going to follow Jesus. So those are the five thresholds, but we actually see them play out in Ruth's life. But the very first thing is that you have to trust a Christian. That's the very first hurdle for people to go. Now, in the book, they're like, we don't know why people cross these thresholds. We have no idea what it is other than the Holy Spirit miraculously working in people's lives. Salvation is a mystery. So we don't know why they go from one step to the next. There's no discernible reason other than the Holy Spirit is supernaturally working in them. But these five things happen over and over in people's lives. And besides that being a good truth for us to know and just helpful for us, man, it's really interesting that we see Ruth doing that. She took steps toward God because of her trust and relationship with Naomi. That's so beautiful and so profound. That's one reason why hospitality is such a big deal for us here. We just imagine what kind of life change we could see here in Roanoke if people can feel Jesus' love through us. That's the first step. That's the first hurdle for them. The first threshold they have to cross is trusting someone. That's what Ruth did here. It's very interesting. But let's finish out the story here, and then we'll wrap it up. When Naomi saw that Ruth was determined to go with her, in verse 18, she stopped talking to her. Okay, she's like, okay, fine, I'm not going to try anymore. And then the two of them traveled until they came to Bethlehem. And when they entered Bethlehem, the whole town was excited about their arrival. And the local women exclaimed, can this be Naomi? And she says, don't call me Naomi. Call me Mara, she answered, for the Almighty has made me very bitter. I went away full, but the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi, since the Lord has opposed me and the Almighty has afflicted me? And then the author just sums all this section up in verse 22. So Naomi came back from the territory of Moab with her daughter-in-law, Ruth the Moabitess. That's an interesting word. Mobitus, whatever. They arrived in Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. It's just a wrap up there. But this is essentially the first scene that ends here in the story of Ruth. So I can't wait to get into the coming weeks here for the rest of it. This is the first act of the short story that we're reading. And I just want to point out how cool it is that when they get back to Bethlehem, the people, the women in Bethlehem, they're excited. They remember Naomi. They're like, man, I can't believe she's here. This is great. She's come back into God's people, into God's presence. And I think that's really interesting. No judgment, just joy that somebody's come back into the presence of God, right? That's what we want to have here when people come back at Redemption Church. But it's also evident that Naomi, even though she's taking these steps toward God, she's still bitter, right? It doesn't just imply that. It says it. She's like, don't call me Naomi, which means something like sweet in Hebrew. It sounds like the word for sweet. She's like, call me bitter. That's what Mara means. Call me bitter because I'm still bitter. So it's really interesting. You can imagine Ruth as she was standing there next to Naomi, and she's like, hey, I've lost everything. I'm empty-handed. I don't come back with anything. Surely Ruth, at least in my mind, is like, what, am I chopped liver here? Come on. I came with you, you know? I mean, we just saw this beautiful conversion moment where Ruth and Naomi have this love for one another, and Ruth begins to follow Naomi's God. And Naomi's just like, yeah, nah, it doesn't mean anything. I've lost it all, you know? She's still in her bitterness. And sometimes bitterness can do the same for us. Maybe we can lose track of what God is doing around us for our selfishness. Because that's essentially what bitterness does, right? It causes us to look inward at ourselves more than we look at God and what he's done. We're just worried about what we don't have that we want, you know? We're bitter about it. So we forget to look and see how God's working under the surface and how to lean into his love. You know? So Naomi does that, though. She's leaning in, but she's still frustrated. She's complex. But if that's where you're at today and you feel bitter about something, you don't have what you want, or you're not where you want to be in life, or whatever it is for you, and you get that bitterness that wells up, man, my call to you and Ruth's call for us is to lean into God's love today. Don't run from him. Don't leave his love. Lean into it. Don't get bitter at God. Man, trust in God's circumstances for your life. Why can we trust God? Because of his chesed that we talked about to begin with. His love is loyal and it's long-lasting. And how do we know this in our context? Well, it's because through Ruth's lineage, as she gets in and marries Boaz and they have kids, and then King David comes, and then through David's lineage, who else is going to come in the future for us to be God's full expression of his love? Jesus, right? We know God's love is so long-lasting and so loyal that he sent his own son into the world to die for us and to take the bitterness onto himself that we deserve for our rebellion. Because see, oftentimes bitterness is something we cause in ourselves. We don't trust God. We look selfishly inward. The bitterness is our own problem. And yet God enters in and says, you don't have to be bitter anymore. I'm going to provide a sweet love for you for all eternity that can change your life. So you can write this down if you're taking notes. Jesus drank the bitter cup of death for us so that we could drink the joy of God's unfailing love forever. That's the beauty of the love, the chesed that God has for us. See, in the Garden of Gethsemane, Jesus pleaded with the Father to let this cup pass from him, if you remember that. And he prayed in Matthew 26, my Father, if it's possible, let this cup of suffering be taken away from me, yet I want your will to be done, not mine. And as it turns out, it was God's will to pour out all of his wrath on to Jesus in that moment. He didn't let that cup pass by, and he made Jesus drink it all. He poured it all out. And there was no other way to save those who couldn't save themselves, but to see this happen where all of God's wrath was poured out on Jesus. This is what Psalm 75 prophesies about this ahead of time. It said, for the Lord holds a cup in his hand that's full of foaming wine mixed with spices. And he pours out the wine in judgment, and all the wicked must drink it, draining it to the dregs. And see, the problem is we're all wicked. We all follow our own way. We all rebel and we all leave God for some reason or another in some way, shape, or form. The prophet Isaiah says it like this, wake yourself. Wake yourself up and stand up, Jerusalem. You who have drunk the cup of his fury from the Lord's hand. You who have drunk the goblet to the dregs. The cup that causes people to stagger. See, this is what our bitterness deserves. Our bitterness deserves God's fury and God's wrath. We, like Elimelech and his family, have run away from God. We've wandered. We're prone to leave the God we love, right? That's how the hymn says it. We don't have what we want because we don't ask with right motives, as James talks about. We'd rather leave God and his presence and try to pursue after things that we want. We've rejected God, and that deserves punishment. Yet, his love, his chesed, his loyal love that lasts, it pursued after us, even in our bitterness, even in our rebellion. Because Isaiah goes on to write this, "This is what your Lord says, your Lord, the Lord, even your God, who defends his people. Look, I have removed from your hand the cup that causes staggering, that goblet, the cup of my fury. You'll never drink it again." Why? Because Jesus drank the cup for us. That's why. He drank the cup of that bitterness in our place, down to the very last drops, down to the dregs, so that even in our sinful state, we could know and be known by the Creator of the universe and be unleashed to live in a way that reflects his love, his chesed, to all the people around us. Just like what Naomi was. She was being used by God even in her bitterness, and she didn't even see it yet. Now, she's going to come to see it in the coming weeks, and we're going to study that in the next few chapters that come up. She's finally going to start to live in that joy that that God has for her. So she's going to see it eventually. But even now, he's working, even in the midst of her sinfulness, to bring about his glory for her good, ultimately. It's going to be really fun to see that play out in the coming weeks. But he's unleashing us today. If we simply believe this truth about who Jesus is to us. See, Jesus leaned into the cross so that we could lean into God's love for us. It's like we're standing in front of a dam that's about to break. You know, maybe you have seen the Hoover Dam, or you've even driven on top of it or been around it. You know, if you just think of standing in front of the Hoover Dam, right? The Hoover Dam is over 700 feet tall. That means it's over 60 stories tall. If you want to think of it in context, it's like looking at the Wells Fargo Tower downtown and seeing three of those stacked on top of one another. Now just imagine you're standing at the bottom of that dam and you look up at the dam and there's rumbling and there's shaking and you hear cracks and the dam's about to break. That's what it's like for each of us with God's wrath. He's pouring out his fury on our sin. And what happens is as we look at that dam and it begins to break apart and we see the water rushing toward us and we can't escape it. There's no way that we can get away from this. All of a sudden the ground opens up in front of us, this massive cavern, and it swallows all of the water so that it doesn't touch us at all. Not a drop of the water gets on us, and then the ground closes back up and we're saved. That's exactly what it's like that Jesus has done for us. Jesus swallowed all of God's wrath on our part, on our behalf. He did that for us. He swallowed so that not even a drop of God's fury would be out on us. You know, we always think that God's looking down on us, you know, in a way like looking down his nose thinking, oh, there they go again. I'm so disappointed in my son or daughter because of what they've done. That's not, there's no fury, no judgment, only grace for us because it was all poured out on Jesus. Now, at the end of time, if we haven't put our faith in Jesus, then that's still coming for us. That's what the Bible teaches us. But if we trust in his salvation and know that he's drank it all for us, we can live with God forever in his presence with his people. We can be back with God in his presence for all time. Man, if you believe that today, then turn your bitterness into joy. Recognize your bad circumstances pale in comparison to being in God's presence with his people. Trust in him. Lean into God's love in the gospel, for you don't run from him today. Turn and lean into him. And the cool thing is, when you start to lean in, you never know who else is going to be watching you that might lean in with you. Let's pray.